our instructions are, we're not to hear you on this tape. Okay?
I think we have a tape of you.
One of the most interesting personalities we met was Nebe Samuel. His name was Samuel. What's his name? Herbert Samuel.
Wasn't he an Englishman?
Yes. He was originally an Englishman.
I recall the name.
And his father was the first high commissioner for Palestine under the mandate after the First World War. And he was a soldier there in 1917, 1918 in Allenby's army. And his nickname was Nebe Samuel, and he wrote a good number of books. He lectured here for a semester at Pitt, and we became very close friends, and he died several years ago, and his widow is still living, and we do visit her. Kitty visited her just this last time we were there. She's in one of these homes, one of these way stations on the way to the cemetery.
That's an apt description, isn't it?
Yeah.
You mentioned Teddy Kollek. What about him? He's pretty effective, I gather.
Oh, yeah, because he's an outgoing, natural leader of individuals, a man of great strength and talent and vision, and he's been a godsend for Jerusalem, and there'll be a big vacuum there. He's 75 years young now, and good eater. He loves to eat. I don't know, he used to weigh 300 pounds, probably he's gotten down to 260 now, maybe 250. But he carries on a very active life, and a great leader.
Is he effective with the Arab population?
Well, they have respect for him. Respect for him because he has never compromised his integrity with them. And he's a bridge to the Arab from Jerusalem.
Did you ever have any contact with Abba Eban?
Not really, not much, no. He's a very aloof guy. Very aloof fellow.
You get that impression.
Yeah, he's hard to get close to, and we didn't have occasion to have much to do with him. He wasn't in the line of activity that, you know, we were in the people in finance and industry and commerce, those activities in Histadrut, the labor movement, and in government-wise. Those are the ones that we visited and interacted. We didn't have anything much to do with foreign affairs. During all that time, of course, he was foreign minister and out of the country a good deal of the time.
I've lost track of dates, but who was the first prime minister you had contact with there? Ben Gurion, before your time?
It'd be Ben Gurion.
Oh, did you have contact with Ben Gurion?
Yeah, we had a Shabbat dinner with him down at Sadeh Boker one time. He came into the dining room all dressed up, with a dark suit and a collar, white shirt and a tie on. I thought I'd faint.
I don't think I ever saw a picture of him with a tie.
I thought I'd faint, but that's where he came into the dining room. But we really weren't with him there. I mean, we met him. We were guests of Yeshua Cohn, who was the leader of the Sadeh Boker, lieutenant of Ben Gurion's. He was no longer prime minister. But I had contact with Ben Gurion early in the time of the state, even before that, during the war. He was here, he was here in this country part of the Second World War.
Yeah, for what purpose?
Raising money and getting guns for the creation of Israel. Abba Hushi later became mayor of Haifa. I had contact with him when he was just a roving activist for the Histadrut, had missions to do in this country.
I believe I read somewhere in the past that Ben Gurion sent Golda Meir here for purposes of fundraising.
Oh, yeah. We used to see a lot of Golda. I remember she was here raising money for different things when she was here, wanting to buy a bunch of Quonset huts. I remember sitting next to her at the Concordia Club. I was there. And I had contact with George Fink, who was president of the National Steel Company at the time, Great Lakes Steel Division, that made these Quonset huts. They're the half-moon shaped ones, these corrugated sheet that they use for the Marbarat, I think is the temporary
house. We used them during the war, didn't we?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Sure. And they were very economical at that time, very economical product made out of galvanized corrugated sheeting. And a number of those were acquired and moved to Israel with monies raised for it. We got them wholesale.
What were they used for in Israel? Temporary
for
housing?
Temporary for immigrants. Temporary housing before they could get permanent housing.
What about Begin?
Never had anything to do with him. He was always opposition, never took him seriously. I never ever bothered to go visit with him, although my attorney in Tel Aviv was of his party and always thought that I ought to sit down and meet with him. He's a very interesting fellow, which I later found out he was. But I was a laborite and a partisan. We never took him seriously, and he would have never come to power if it weren't for the split that followed the Yom Kippur War.
But why did you not take him seriously?
He was, because he was just a leader of a minority faction, and he didn't stand for anything that we were interested in.
I see.
He had an entirely different view and vision, and he really messed up the economy of Israel. He really messed it up.
How did he do
that? By doing all the wrong things at the right time. This Friedman fellow from Chicago, he went in for a free economy. The first thing that happened under Begin was that the private...
You're referring to Milton Friedman?
Yeah, Milton Friedman. He came over as an advisor, and he didn't know what he was advising, because Israel is not a political economy. It's a conglomerate corporation with a political base about one third the size of General Electric, and the debt that was incurred under Begin, unbelievable. Anyway, that's a whole other story.
Well, what about the present leadership situation there?
Well, we're without leadership in Israel today. I mean, we have no leader who commands a decision-making majority, so that it's all coalition government, and consensus activity. Now there's great trepidation that the Labor Party had turned over the premiership to Shamir from the Karit. Our lack of an equivalent of Ben-Gurion. Begin became a national figure, and he commanded a majority through coalition. But I don't think he would go down as anything like Ben-Gurion, although he did agree to the Camp David agreement, but he gave away Sinai, which he didn't have to do. But Dayan is the man who did the Camp David agreement. Begin has forced down his throat as much as anything else. It's Dayan. All the literature and all the reports come out and books that are written now. It's Dayan who was the key man in arranging it and in seeing it through to the agreement that was achieved, which agreement will last until the Egyptian Revolution, which is just around the corner. The Egyptian Revolution will be similar to the one in Iran. It's inevitable and it's on the way.
That's a gloomy forecast.
Well, it's realistic, you know, gloom and doom and hope and inspiration, all wrapped up together.
Do you think that there will be a switch in the leadership?
Well, if you have a revolution in Egypt, why could it be in the direction of fundamentalist Islamic?
I see.
You've got so many hungry people there. Gosh, you've got hundreds of thousands of people living in cemeteries.
To return to Israel there, due to switch to... they have an agreement there that one is to be leader and
that's
the other
right. Yeah, it was 2 years each, because they each had about the same percentage
of votes.
And neither of them could form a government on its own.
Do you think that transition will take place?
Well, that's anybody's guess. The odds are it will. Certainly a lot of people on both sides who don't want it to happen, but it probably will. But I'm no expert on whether that will happen or not. I don't know anything more about that than the average person does.
Here, you and your wife have been involved with Temple Sinai here. Have you any synagogue involvement in Israel?
Yes, we've been active in the Hebrew Union College. We have a synagogue, the Beit HaKnesset, as part of the Hebrew Union College on King David Street, right below the King David Hotel. And the World Union for Progressive Judaism are having a dedication of their new building right next to the college this fall, probably sometime in October or November. And we've been very active there. And then there's another Reformed temple on the Shmuel Hanagin up near the Betzara Art Institute, the original one. I forget the name of it, but we've been there for bar mitzvahs and weddings. All the weddings usually take place in public places. That's it.
How is the Reform movement faring in Israel? Are they making inroads?
Well, yeah, they got about eight or nine congregations, and they're building a big temple now in Tel Aviv. Moshe Zemer is the rabbi there of that temple, and Kitty and I had lunch with him and his family this last time we were in Israel. He lives there in the Tel Aviv area.
But the Orthodox element is very disapproving of them.
Well, the Orthodox have got a strong, they've had a stranglehold on the affairs, religious,
and political, don't they?
Yes, because they're a swing vote. Nobody's been able to rule without them, so therefore they've been able to blackmail whoever's in power, all kinds of things.
Mr. Rutenberg, does your lifestyle in Israel differ from your lifestyle here in Pittsburgh?
Oh, of course. I mean, it's an entirely different culture. I mean, you intermingle with individuals there in a very deep way. And life is intense there. Here it's superficial. You don't have intense relations with very many individuals living in America, but you do there in Israel. For example, you have your intimate friends that went to high school or grade school together, college together, and you don't replace them in midlife or later life in this country. But in Israel, why, you can develop relationships with adults that have about your same age or even younger or older, just as intimate and as intense as any relationship you ever had with a high school buddy or college roommate.
Why is that?
Because life is intense there. It's got a meaning to it. They've got a purpose there. Here, all
survival.
Survival. Here, we all have a problem with survival in America. We're all engaged in our own individual activity to make our own living, look after ourselves, take care of ourselves. We're individually oriented, whereas in Israel, why, there's group oriented. You're part of something bigger. I mean, Israel itself serves the equivalent of a religion. What is religion? Religion is it just being part of something larger than yourself. That's why there are Buddhists, and there are Muslims, and there are Jews, and Christians, and Hindus. When we went around the world on our trip, why, everywhere we went, they were lighting candles for the dead, whether they were Chinese in Thailand or Malaya, or whether they were Spanish in Santiago, Chile, where they were Jews on Mount Zion. They're all lighting candles to the dead. I mean, it's the same thing there. In India, they were burning incense. Pakistan, they had candles. Pakistan. Well, Zoroaster, or something like that, religion there, which has many practices. They have bar mitzvah equivalent. And they burn candles. But the Hindus and the Chinese had candles and incense, both at the cemetery on the what would be the equivalent of our Memorial Day.
It's interesting what you were saying about the intense relationship that people have in Israel. Is this why you like going there, or living there?
Sure, you live there. It just exists in America.
Why do you think there's such a difference? You say there's more. You did say it's because they're more.
You're there with it. You're part of something that's bigger than yourself, which is the building and creation and the maintenance of the state. And of course, you use the word survival. Yes, of course, it's a matter of survival because there are enemies there that would like to eliminate you. And that gives a closeness. And it's one big family. I mean, if some soldier boy is killed on the front, it reverberates throughout the whole country.
What significance does living in Israel have for you personally, Mr. Weaver?
Well, that my heart and soul and my spiritual being is in Jerusalem, not in Bethlehem. So I'm not active in the community activities here in Pittsburgh, but I'm active in Jerusalem. And I don't yield to the normal pressures of Pittsburgh, but I do in Jerusalem, the communal pressures of Jerusalem.
You're active in community activities there?
Well, yes, you're active more financially than any other way, but that's mostly what I would be active here. We give money here in the States too, but we're more interested. I'm more interested in Jerusalem, so am I.
Well, what are your observations on the situation in Israel today, politically, economically, your concerns?
Well, it's still a struggling nation trying to develop a viable economy and answer to problems that are unsolvable. I mean, you've got irreconcilable neighbors on the borders. It took a great act of faith to believe that we could create the state of Israel, and today it takes an equally great act of faith to believe that we can maintain it.
Are you optimistic about it at this time?
Well, optimism is my definition of Judaism. Jewish people were not, individually and as a group, they were not optimistic, they wouldn't be in existence today.
I think that's a good statement.
Judaism is optimism. It's just one word for it.
We're just about finished with this.
Were you in Israel during war periods?
Yeah, Kitty and I were there during the time that the Yom Kippur War broke out. We heard the airplanes flying on Yom Kippur morning at 5:35. And I looked at my watch and I said, those jets wouldn't be flying if hell weren't breaking loose somewhere. And it was officially declared about 1:30 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon of the war. But I knew at that instant that there was something.
You remained there during the war period?
Yes, and Kitty stayed on, and she drove the soldiers in our car, and then Marsha Davenport came, and Marsha Rip came from Pittsburgh with her, and they rented a car, and the two of them with the two cars kept delivering soldiers from Jerusalem down to Jericho and over to Ramallah.
Did you have any active role in
it? No, I was there for about a week after the Yom Kippur War began, and then whenever the back of the Egyptian army was broken, I was able to leave, which I had to go back here to the States.
Were you in Israel at the time of the Sadat visit?
No, but my wife was. And, so she's the authority on that subject. It was a great event. Sadat was a great event. And of course, he was assassinated because that's the policy of the Arabs, is to assassinate those who make peace with the infidel. Infidel is anyone who's not part of your Muslim group.
Any other comments you care to add about Israel that we haven't covered?
Well, it's a unique experience to live at a time when the State of Israel is created, simultaneously whenever you have the great Jewish Renaissance that started in great motion right after the Second World War. And I participated in that in all forms. Simultaneously, you had the creation of the State of Israel, both of them. Two biggest events in the history of the Jewish people.
What do you mean by the Jewish Renaissance? I'm not clear.
Well, I mean, Jews are, if you have the talent and the energy, put in the effort, you can do anything in America you want to do. You can do what ICON, take over TWA, you can do what I do, you can do what Kissinger does, you can do what...
you have to have... some degree of talent, I'd say.
Well, no, the opportunity. I mean, there was plenty of talent before the Second World War that didn't become medical doctors and scientists that couldn't get into the schools in any significant number. No, I mean, what the way we exist today with relative freedom here, which and freedom and opportunity is unique in the history of the Jewish people.
You have to be grateful for that.
Yeah, it won't last forever either, but it's here today.
Do you think that there is, do you notice or do you see any anti-Semitism developing now?
Oh, yeah, there's more anti-Semitism today than there was in 1906 when B'nai B'rith was organized, when the Anti-Defamation League was created, because there are more Americans. And the anti-Semitism is endemic to a Christian country. This is a Christian country, no less so than England was a Christian country when they expelled the Jews, and Spain was a Christian country when they kicked the Jews out, and Germany was a Christian country when they slaughtered the Jews, and the Russians were a Christian country. I mean, it's endemic, I mean, and there's no solution to the problem. All you can do is develop practical accommodations from generation to generation.
Well, how do you account for the opening up of more avenues of opportunity now?
Well, there it is. There it is. It's a renaissance, and it's there, but that doesn't, that is independent of the anti-Semitism. Is not of a character which would be political force that would keep the Jews down because they're Jews. We have an open society here, and Jews with talent can move on. But bear in mind, there are thousands, millions of our Jewish people here who just eke out a living. Who don't, you know, it's a great opportunity, isn't there? Everybody is able to take care of the great opportunity, but they're all subject to